From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 16th, 2015. And on this day, has a legislative panel investigating Governor Paul LePage's threats to cut off funding for a Fairfield nonprofit gone too far or not far enough? A.J. Higgins has the latest. Skeletal remains found deep in the Maine woods are likely those of a Tennessee hiker who disappeared on the Appalachian Trail more than 2 years ago. And Maine worm diggers take issue with new clam harvesting rules. That and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. Some Maine lawmakers are questioning the goal of the legislature's Government Oversight Committee as it investigates Governor Paul LePage's threats to cut off funding to the Goodwill Hinckley School after it hired a political rival. Meanwhile, some members of the public say the panel should be focusing on ways to impeach the governor, while House Republican leader Ken Fredette says the investigation has gone too far. Members of the committee, though, say they're simply trying to get as much information about the incident as they can. A.J. Higgins has more.
At Thursday's public hearing before the Government Oversight Committee, some citizens made it clear they had reached a verdict on whether Governor LePage had overstepped his authority in threatening to withhold funds from Goodwill Hinckley. There was Cushing Sam.
You must make your findings, and then I would hope that you would turn the matter over to the House to consider impeachment.
Rebecca Halbrook.
Ultimately, we do hope that Governor LePage will resign from his office.
And Davy Crockett.
We need to remove this individual from office. He is doing nothing but disgracing the state of Maine.
But commission members say none of that is part of their mission. Instead, they are only out to verify the facts. A lengthy report from the legislature's Office of Program Evaluation and Government Accountability has verified much of what has already been reported in the media and stated by principals involved in the matter, which came to light this spring. Democratic House Speaker Mark Eaves, a longtime adversary of LePage's, accepted a $120,000 a year position with the charter school in Fairfield, operated by the nonprofit Goodwill Hinckley. The school board's chairman confirmed Thursday that LePage had sent him a note in which he made clear that he would withhold $500,000 in state funding unless the school rescinded its contract to hire Eaves as its next president. The school, fearful that it could also lose significant funding from the Harold Alphond Foundation, withdrew its offer to Eaves, who has since filed a lawsuit against the governor. While questions have been raised about whether LePage abused his power in the case, Senator David Burns of Whiting says,
"That's not what we're here for. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of angst about this whole thing. I feel there's a lot of people that want to culminate what they feel has been several years of mismanagement, if you will, of the Blaine House and the governor's office."
The committee voted 8-3 on Thursday to subpoena two top aides of LePage and say they also want to talk to more than a half dozen other people who had knowledge about the funding threat. And House Republican leader Ken Fredette of Newport says the committee's decision to seek subpoenas and interview state employees, lobbyists, and administration figures is evidence that the panel has gone too far.
I think right at the beginning of this process, I expressed my concern that this committee was operating above its jurisdiction and beyond its jurisdiction.
Fredette says the panel seems to be using its authority to gather information about the events as a pretext to substantiate articles of impeachment against the governor. That's something that Fredette says belongs solely within the jurisdiction of the Maine House of Representatives.
And I think that this is an end run around that process. I just see the line starting to blur.
Beth Ashcroft is the executive director for OPEGA and says there is no end run around the impeachment process. What the Maine House chooses to do with the OPEGA report and the commission investigation, she says, is entirely up to legislative leaders.
To the extent that we are a resource and support the legislature, that we could do the fact-finding to make sure there was an understanding of the facts about what actually occurred. There was a request right from the beginning to pass on whatever we had learned to the House. And so what form that will take, I don't know.
The committee will resume its work on November 12th. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Meanwhile, the nuts and bolts work of government continues. Governor LePage today announced that former Husson University leader Bill Beardsley will serve as the state's next acting education commissioner. Beardsley headed Husson from 1987 to 2010, then served as LePage's conservation commissioner until that department merged with the Department of Agriculture in 2012. Tom Desjardins was acting commissioner for 6 months, as allowed by statute. He'll continue to serve as acting deputy commissioner when he comes back to work after recovering from a fall in his barn. Republicans in the Maine legislature, meanwhile, are urging legislative leaders to allow a package of bills into the upcoming session that target Planned Parenthood. At a State House news conference today, supporters said the measures will bring accountability to state funds used by the health provider. One would shift family planning funds to another provider, while another would regulate the disposal of fetal tissue. Assistant House Majority Leader Sarah Gideon, a Democrat from Freeport, says Democratic leaders will vote to block all of the bills.
I would say that since there is no fetal research, tissue research in the state of Maine, that this really feels like a witch hunt.
At issue is the national debate over allegations of misuse of fetal tissue, which Planned Parenthood officials deny. In Maine, 10 elected legislative leaders, 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans, decide which bills are allowed into the January session. If all the Democrats on the panel object, the bills fail. There is another way to get them into the session, however. Governor Paul LePage can submit legislation at any time, and Gideon says she wouldn't be surprised to see that happen in this case. Coming up, a forestry contractor working deep in the Maine woods stumbles on what authorities say are very likely the remains of a Tennessee woman who went missing on the Appalachian Trail more than 2 years ago. It's been more than 2 years since 66-year-old Geraldine Largay disappeared while hiking the Appalachian Trail in Maine. Now, authorities say they've finally found what they believe are Largay's remains in western Maine's Reddington Township. As Patty White reports, the discovery brings some closure, although questions regarding Largay's death remain.
On Wednesday morning, a contractor conducting a forestry survey on U.S. Navy-owned property in western Maine discovered human remains. He reported the finding, and the following morning, state and naval investigators hiked into the scene. John McDonald of the Maine Warden Service says investigators have not yet made a positive identification.
However, due to the location of the remains and evidence gathered at the scene, the Maine Warden Service feels confident that Geraldine has now been located.
Geraldine Largay went missing on July 22, 2013. The 66-year-old woman from Tennessee had been hiking the Appalachian Trail since April. McDonald says Largay was last seen leaving Poplar Lean-To in Reddington Township, heading north to meet her husband the next day.
Who was waiting there to meet her at the Route 27 crossing. Geraldine never arrived at that location.
Over the course of 2 years, search teams scoured about 23 miles of terrain but found no evidence of Largay. A $25,000 reward was offered for information on her disappearance. Ultimately, says McDonald, Largay's remains were found about 3,000 feet from the trail.
The remains will be examined to determine the cause of death, although investigators do not believe foul play is involved at this time.
Why Largay left the remote rugged trail is unclear, says State Search and Rescue Coordinator Lieutenant Kevin Adam. Largay was found about 100 yards inside the boundary of Navy property in a wooded area.
There's a lot of her belongings that we found that we have to still go through and see if there's any other clues there as to what we can glean from that.
Warden Service officials say Largay's family is requesting privacy at this time, but expressed gratitude to searchers and investigators. Kevin Adams says the discovery ends 2 years of uncertainty.
Well, it's a great sense of relief that we have found Jerry and that we can return her to her family. That's the biggest thing.
But along with the relief, says Adam, is sadness. For MPBN News, I'm Patty White.
And Maine has documented its first case of seasonal flu. State epidemiologist Dr. Siri Bennett says it was confirmed in an adult in Sagadahoc County. She says the victim didn't have to be hospitalized. Most cases of flu in healthy adults don't lead to anything more serious than a few days or weeks of misery, Bennett says, but she says everyone should be vaccinated to avoid transmitting the virus to the more vulnerable.
There are people who are at high risk for developing flu-related complications, and we need to make sure that they are indeed vaccinated. This would be children under the age of 5, adults 65 and older, pregnant women, people who have underlying medical conditions.
Up to 20% of the nation's population will come down with some strain of the flu this year, and about 200,000 of them will end up in the hospital. And now from nasty bugs to worms. A vigorous debate is underway concerning access to Maine's shellfish-rich intertidal zone. At the heart of the dispute are clam harvesting regulations, which are set by local cities and towns, and rules governing the taking of bloodworms, which are set by the state. This week, a new state law went into effect that adds protections for Maine's shellfish population, which has been devastated by the invasive European green crab. But many of Maine's 800 or so worm diggers see the law as an unjustified effort to control their activities. Tom Porter has more.
It's low tide at Dipper Cove on Oars Island in Harpswell. Dan Harrington trudges through the mudflats on a so-called spotting mission for bloodworms, which are popular as bait for recreational fishermen. He's president of the Maine Marine Worm Harvesters Association. Moving swiftly through the thick mud, he hand rakes several different spots trying to gauge if there are enough bloodworms here to merit putting in a day's work digging.
Yeah. As far as bloodworms go, there's usually a few here, but so far...
Harrington is in his mid-40s, tall and bearded. He's been worming for 35 years, although on occasion he's had to dig for clams, he says, because the worm harvest ebbs and flows. He digs down about 3 or 4 inches into the mud. After a few minutes, success.
That's a 4.5-inch worm, and... if you were going fishing, that's a usable bait.
Bloodworms are pink-coloured and can be aggressive. When provoked, they'll bite with 4 retractable fangs.
If I grab it like that, you can see the teeth, black teeth. And some people are actually have almost like an allergic reaction to a bite.
Do you get bitten very much?
I get bit all the time.
Worm bites aside, though, Harrington says it's a way of life he enjoys for a number of reasons.
The idea that you're a free agent, for one, and the idea that, you know... to get a little bit personal, I feel that when I go out on the mud, I'm as close to God as anybody can possibly be. I'm surrounded by nature.
Worm digging has been described as the last free industry in Maine. That's because all you need is a $50 state license, says Harrington. Then you're free to roam up and down the coast, searching for the sometimes elusive bloodworm and its less valuable cousin, the sandworm. Wormers and clammers often work the same areas, says Harrington, and sometimes they do get in each other's way. But he's keen to stress that talk of a simmering dispute between the two sets of harvesters is often exaggerated by the media. Nevertheless, worm diggers like Harrington are worried that their freedom is under threat, as under a new law, municipalities can now set limits on worm digging in an effort to protect clams. Harrington's ultimate fear is complete municipal control of the worm harvest.
Which would have a devastating effect on the whole entire industry, especially considering that 40% of your professional worm harvesters do not live in coastal towns, and municipal ordinances only are required to sell 10% of their municipal licensing to non-resident license holders.
What we're looking to do is to protect the intertidal area. Things have gotten worse out there.
Mark Latty is chairman of the Marine Resources Committee in the town of Brunswick, which recently hosted a meeting of 10 surrounding municipalities who came together specifically to look at this issue. The towns, he says, are united by concern over threats to their clam flats, which they're trying to reseed following the devastation caused by the invasive European green crab in recent years. Latty says they want the flats closed to all activity.
We're looking to protect areas from harvesting, from clam harvesting, from worm harvesting, from seaweed harvesting. We want municipalities to have the ability to close an area and allow that area to rebuild or rehabilitate itself.
These efforts received a boost on October 15th when the new state law went into effect that prohibits the disturbance of shellfished harvesting areas until juvenile clams reach harvestable size. Another similar proposal, currently in draft form, is also aimed at protecting conservation areas from worm digging. Proponents say these are important steps in support of Maine's $19 million soft-shell clamming industry, which employs more than 1,500 people. But many clammers also oppose this strategy.
We don't support conservation closures as a management tool.
Chad Coffin is president of the Maine Clammers Association.
It misses the point that, you know, we really need to start moving towards protecting the bounty of the ocean right now that we know we have.
In other words, protecting clam populations from predators, such as the green crab. That's also the opinion of Dr. Brian Beale, professor of marine ecology at UMaine Machias, who studied the issue in depth.
Just simply closing an area doesn't cut it. It doesn't enhance the number of clams that are there.
Beale says that while clamming and, to a lesser extent, worming can both damage the recovery of juvenile clams, by far the biggest threat is predation, and towns need to adopt a more hands-on approach to deal with it.
Using fences, using netting, doing something other than just simply saying, well, this area is off limits.
Unless they're going to take that kind of action, says Beale, towns might as well let worm digging go ahead. But that's not the plan in the Mid-Coast, where Brunswick and other towns plan another meeting on clam flat closures in November. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
And finally tonight, a Maine company that harvests energy from the sea is expanding its presence once again in Canada. Ocean Renewable Power Company is launching a new subsidiary in Montreal, says Vice President for Project Development John Ferland.
Well, I think this is an example of a company that has started up in Maine and has achieved success in Maine, and as a result, there is market interest in what we do globally.
The company has power projects tied to the grid in Eastport, Maine, and on the Quijac River in Alaska. The new subsidiary in Quebec will develop both marine and river power for the province. And that's the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 16th, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to A.J. Higgins, Patty White, Tom Porter, Mal Leary, Jennifer Mitchell, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear from you. You can let us know what you think about the program by emailing us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.